Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program on this Easter Saturday. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Spotlight on the Easter Vigil. On the day the Church celebrates the Easter Saturday Vigil, we take a closer look at the significance, symbolism and history of this vigil with the help of a liturgy expert. Coming home. More than 100,000 adults across the world are received into the Catholic Church during the Easter Vigil ceremony each year, and we find out more about what prompts them to convert to Catholicism. Easter Saturday Reflection. Monsignor Peter Fleetwood reflects on this day, the only day in which Jesus is totally absent from this world after he had descended into the realm of the dead. April the 8th is Easter Sunday, and Pope Benedict will celebrate Easter Mass in front of St. Peter's Basilica and afterwards will deliver his traditional Urbi and Orbi message and blessing to the city and the world. This evening, Pope Benedict was scheduled to preside over the Easter Vigil in St. Peter's Basilica to usher in the day when we celebrate the joy of Christ's resurrection. Often described as the most beautiful liturgy of the Church, with its symbolism of darkness giving way to light, what actually happens and why during this Easter Vigil? And how far back can we trace its history within the Church? Well, to find out more details, I spoke to Father Jan Mike Jonkers, an Associate Professor of Liturgy at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
Today, it would be considered the center of the entire liturgical year. It's the single most important vigil we have, and it's the culmination of the great celebration of Christ's passage from death to life.
And can you explain for our listeners, what are the main characteristics of the actual liturgy?
It would be easiest to think of the liturgy falling into four great parts. A liturgy first of light, which centers on the kindling of a fire and the blessing of a candle and the singing of an Easter proclamation, so all about light. Then secondly, a lengthy service of God's Word, multiple readings and psalms and collects culminating in the Gospel for Easter. The third section is water rites. They're all associated with Christian initiation, so the baptism of infants or adults. And then finally, the Easter Mass, and that's the conclusion and culmination of the entire service.
And what about its history in the Church? Mm. Can we trace back when it first sort of evolved as a very distinctive event?
Mm-hmm. We actually can, but it's quite complex, so I'm going to make this very simple. We have some evidence for baptismal activity in Rome from a couple of documents in the 2nd and 3rd century, Justin Martyr and the so-called apostolic tradition. But we don't know that they're necessarily connected with the Easter Vigil. Then we get information about the Triduum, the Good Friday, Holy Saturday, Easter celebration, and some insight into the vigil, but we're not necessarily sure that the baptisms are done then. So it's not actually until we get to the 8th century that we have documents for all of these elements being part of the Roman celebration of the Easter Vigil.
As it's known, the Easter Vigil is the traditional time when people join the Catholic Church. They are either baptized or formally received into the Church. When and why did that tradition and practice first start?
Again, those letters that I mentioned, we have some letters from Siricius and Decentius, early popes, and they indicate that the Roman custom was only to initiate Christians on 2 days out of the year. They did it on Easter, and then they did it 50 days later on Pentecost. Of course, they also said, in case of an emergency, we'll baptize. But the formal, public, great celebrations of initiation just twice in a year. Why? because you're connecting them so deeply with the passage of Christ from death to life, Easter, and the pouring out of his Spirit on Pentecost.
You mentioned that the liturgy is divided into four parts, but can you perhaps very briefly sort of run through what actually happens from start to finish?
I can try. In the light service, first we kindle a new fire and bless it. We trace a cross on the great paschal candle and put some grains of incense in it. Then we light the paschal candle. We proclaim three times, Christ our light, and the whole congregation sings, thanks be to God. And then the high point, of course, is the deacon, or if the deacon can't do this, a cantor, singing the Exultet, which is a long, long, rapturous, lyrical piece, praising God for the gift of light. So that's the first part. Second part is a lengthy word service. We could have seven readings and follow each of them followed by the singing of a psalm, each of them followed by a prayer called a collect, one right after another. So we're really pondering the depth of this meaning. And at the conclusion of all of those readings, then we sing the Gloria, we have an epistle reading, another psalm, and then the great Easter gospel. Lots of alleluias being sung at that point.
And how long does it last from start to finish?
Well, in a certain sense, this is meant to be a night vigil, so it has to start after sunset. And the hope is that somewhere around midnight we'll actually be celebrating the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. So it could last quite a while. There are even some monastic communities that take those seven readings that I mentioned, and they do the reading followed by the psalm, followed by the prayer. They do one of those an hour, so that this lasts from sunset until dawn.
So that is indeed a very long vigil.
Very long vigil.
Yes, okay. As you say, there's a lot of wonderful, joyful texts that we're going to be hearing during this Easter vigil. Can you single out for us one that you think is particularly worthy of sharing with our listeners?
I would love to. And this is from that Exultet that I mentioned, when the deacon is singing, this is the night when Christians everywhere, washed clean of sin and freed from all defilement, are restored to grace and grow together in holiness. This is the night when Jesus Christ broke the chains of death and rose triumphant from the grave.
Lovely words.
They are.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
I was speaking to Father Jan Michael Jongers, a professor of liturgy. During the Easter Vigil ceremony each year, hundreds of thousands of adults throughout the world are received into the Catholic Church. And I've been finding out more about the reasons that prompted several recent converts to undertake that spiritual journey. Let's hear my report.
I feel with Catholicism that I've come home.
When I tried to find out more from the perspective of the converts themselves, this was the common feeling expressed by all those who have just joined the church. I spoke to two people in London, one of whom you just heard, and then a woman in Washington, D.C., and a man from Maryland. Let's hear, first of all, what they had to say about their reasons for converting to Catholicism. My first interviewee is Ivo Vermeulen, a Dutchman living in Britain who works for a banking firm in London. He was baptised a Catholic at Easter in 2008.
There were various reasons as to why I chose to convert to Catholicism. First of all, my family, at least on my father's side, has always been Catholic, but Catholicism became less and less important in their lives. So for me, it was a matter of going back to our faith. But at the same time, it's also, I think, a point in my life where you reflect on where you stand in life. I'm due to get married, as my future wife is Catholic and then a very devoted Catholic. I decided this was a very good time to go back to Catholicism.
My next is Kate Campbell, a former Anglican who works as an advertising executive in London. She was received into the Catholic Church during the Easter Vigil of 2008.
I was actually christened in a very high Anglican church, which is Anglo-Catholic. So I was used to the incense and the genuflecting, but I sort of was moved away from that family-wise. And it's been something I've always felt I never belonged in the Anglican church. I suppose this really crystallized when I met my now husband, who was a Catholic. I suppose it really came home to me when we were doing the marriage preparation course. We were married in September 2006. The woman who was taking the course at Westminster Cathedral, Rosie, there was something about her. And when she was going through the marriage service and the actual words, something happened in that room. It was the Holy Spirit was there, definitely. I have never seen people so affected. A lot of the girls were in tears, and it was so moving. And it made me think very, very deeply that not only was I about to undertake a Catholic marriage, but I thought this is calling me to actually become a Catholic. But it took another year of me pondering this deeply before I started going to the RCIA class.
Let's now cross over the Atlantic and hear the reasons given by two Americans. The first is Lauren Zumo, a book restorer from Washington, D.C., who was born and raised a Jew and who was also received into the church during the Easter Vigil of 2008.
I guess the first thing was that I met and fell in love with a Catholic man. And when I met Paul, he was extremely religious, and I was not very religious. I grew up celebrating all of the sort of big holidays, you know, twice a year. I went to synagogue and we celebrated Passover, but it wasn't a daily part of our lives. But my now husband was a daily mass goer, and he was very much practicing his religion. And so when I met him, I knew that I liked him immediately, but I knew that we had this big disconnect in our backgrounds. And so I just started going to Mass with him on Sunday just to sort of get to know him and to try and see if this relationship had a future. And I guess it kind of took, and that God had other plans for me that I wasn't expecting. It was, in a way, not joining the enemy, but joining the other team. And it was a struggle to sort of see Jesus as Messiah.
And finally, let's hear from Mike Martz, a printer from Huntington, Maryland, who also was received into the church.
Been married to my wife for 35 years. We raised our children, you know, in the Catholic Church, and it was kind of a bystander. I should have done a better job. And a couple of things happened last year. We lost a loved one to a tragedy, and my wife's cousin said if one person came back to the church, my daughter's death wouldn't be a loss. And it just kind of triggered something in me, and I decided, I've been thinking about it for years, and just decided to do it now.
So, as we've heard, deciding to become a Catholic is rarely a sudden blinding flash of inspiration along the lines of St. Paul's dramatic conversion en route to Damascus. And in fact, very often, a key factor in many people's conversion is the fact that their spouse or future spouse is a Catholic. Mike says although he had been brought up as a Christian, he had drifted away from his faith before he met his Catholic wife.
I was baptized in the Episcopal Church, and I went for a while, but the family was not a real church-going family. My parents didn't go, and then they wanted me to go, and I went for a few years, and then I just kind of drifted away from the church and never quite went back.
Ivo's parents, on the other hand, didn't bring him up in any particular faith at all, but left such decisions entirely up to him.
I was not brought up with any particular faith. My parents wanted to make sure that as I was brought up, that I would respect each and every religion, that I would make my own decisions. So especially coming from my mother, I think there was a compromise between my parents where they said, well, even though my father was obviously Catholic, there was a decision made that I was going to be raised in a very neutral, so that I was going to make my own judgment, my own decisions. So hence the decision to now convert to Catholicism did not so much come from them, but obviously they do support it.
So, I mean, you weren't going to church on a Sunday, for instance?
I did not, no.
But how has their conversion to Catholicism changed their views on life? All of the converts believe that becoming a Catholic had changed them for the better as a person. Lauren and Mike told me their decision had changed their entire outlook on life.
Well, I'd say it changed just about everything. I really saw the world in an entirely different framework than I did before.
Basically, it's changed my entire outlook on what I watch on television, how I think and how I feel, and my prayer and being able to forgive people for some things, and had a pretty rough childhood, and it has just made me be a better person.
Kate, too, echoes that feeling of being more aware of the rights and wrongs in our life.
In a way, I suppose I've been coming to terms with Catholicism for some time, since I met my husband, and I've been going to Mass with him for a long time as well. And I think it has changed things. I feel more comfortable. I feel as if I'm part of a family. And it certainly made me more aware of the attacks, I suppose, on Christianity that's going on in the world.
As for Ivo, he feels a greater sense of inner peace on becoming a Catholic.
I think these were questions that I asked myself whilst I was in the process of conversion. So in the strictest sense of the word, there's not such a significant change. I do feel I'm more at ease and more at peace at the moment.
But what does Catholicism give them that other faiths cannot provide? Let's hear first from Kate.
We seem to be living in an increasingly secularized society, which bothers me very, very much. And religion seems to be, Christianity rather, seems to be subject to a lot of contempt and a lot of lack of respect. And I suppose the two things came together, and I felt it was time to stand up and be counted. And to me, the Catholic Church seems to be the church that does not sway with every fashionable wind that's blowing. It seems to stand very true and firm. And I think we all need an anchor in our life. And it seemed to me that the Catholic Church was the place where there is an anchor.
Lauren, too, spoke of the importance of having the truth of her religion, one that is fixed and not diluted by passing fads.
It's the truth aspect of Catholicism that I kind of came through both my faith and sort of intellectual reasoning to realize that it was the truth. So I don't think anyone can compete with that. it's not easy, but I don't think anything that's worth doing is easy. And I think that our souls respond to that. And if it's watered down or too simple or too convenient, I think deep down we know that that's not true. And that's not what God wants for us.
Finally, how would they put into words their feelings and emotions as they were received into the Catholic Church or were baptized during the Easter Vigil? Mike and Kate say they have no hesitation in describing it as one of the greatest days of their life.
Probably one of the greatest feelings of my life. It had the parallel when my children were born. I have a peace now that I never had before.
I count my being received into the Catholic Church as the greatest day and happiest day of my life, along with the day that I got married. It's a day I will never forget. It was very moving. I was brimming over with happiness.
So, a moving and emotional experience for all of them. But let's hear Ivo put into words that feeling echoed by so many converts, of how it felt like a homecoming.
It was more emotional than I anticipated it to be, more welcoming and more, say, more natural. The actual celebration itself was, in actual fact, the perfect conclusion of coming into the church, and it did feel like coming home, yes.
I was speaking there to Ivo Vermeulen and Kate Campbell from London, and you also heard the voices of Lauren Zumo from Washington, D.C., and Mike Martz from Maryland. Easter Saturday is the only day of the liturgical calendar in which Jesus is totally absent from this world. And Monsignor Peter Fleetwood from the Liverpool Diocese reflects on the emptiness of this day, when Jesus had descended into the realm of the dead.
Has anyone ever told you to go to hell? It's not a phrase I would like to hear addressed to me, and I must admit I would hesitate before using it myself. I think everyone would hate to be told to go to hell, but the odd thing is that most people in the Western world say they don't believe in hell. The obvious question is, if you don't believe in it, why would such a phrase annoy you? Well, I suppose even people who don't believe in hell recognize that if hell existed, it would be the worst place imaginable. So they would be right to think the person wishing them there would be saying something powerfully negative and being aggressive into the bargain. Pope Benedict has asked Christians to think more about hell as an essential part of the picture our faith presents. He did it during the season of Lent, and I think there's a particular reason for doing it then. The only time, apart from occasional phrases in gospel readings, that hell is mentioned in church, is if we say the shorter version of the proclamation of faith, what we call the Apostles' Creed. After Jesus was crucified, dead and buried, Christians have continued with the words, "He descended into hell." In other words, after the crucifixion, death and burial of Jesus, which we remember on Good Friday, the Apostles' Creed states that Jesus descended into hell before rising on Easter Sunday. That explains why Holy Saturday is such an empty day. The day before Easter is the day when Jesus is totally absent from this world, the only day between his conception and his ascension to heaven. This is not something invented by the later church, but refers to something unusual in the first letter of Peter, where it is written that through the Holy Spirit, Jesus went and preached to the spirits in prison who disobeyed long ago, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. The reason why Jesus made this journey to the spirits in prison is given later in the same letter. God the Father is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this reason, the gospel was preached also to those who are dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, but live according to God in the Spirit. The more modern version of the Apostles' Creed doesn't mention hell, but says Jesus descended to the dead. That doesn't mean hell has been abolished, but simply that the new translation is closer to the first letter of Peter. However, the Greek and the Latin versions of the Apostles' Creed both refer to the lowest places, something like the nether regions or the underworld, which are other ways the English language has for referring to hell. I think this little forgotten part of our faith is very important, and there's something touching and beautiful about it. I had a discussion recently with some very devout Catholic ladies who wondered why Pope Benedict had asked us not to forget about hell. One sister thought there is most certainly a hell, but she just cannot believe that there's anybody there. The other sister was extremely angry. She is not prepared to believe that hell is just a threat. She admitted that she doesn't know anyone personally who deserves to go to hell, but she hopes the people who've committed certain kinds of crimes will be there sooner or later. They asked me who was right. Very embarrassing. I agree with both of them in a way, but in my mind were echoes of what we learned when we studied this in theology. The Church teaches that there is a hell, which involves real punishment for sin, but the Church cannot say whether there's anyone there. I told my two friends that, and also told them I've heard that Orthodox Christians believe that the prayers of the Mother of God are so powerful that at the Last Judgment she will ask God to have mercy on all sinners, and nobody will be damned for eternity. What the Apostles' Creed and the First Letter of Peter tell us is that whatever human beings think of each other's actions, however much we would like to dump serious sinners, God does not leave it there. The gospel is preached to those who are dead so that they can live in the Spirit. Who are these dead people to whom the gospel was preached? They are the people who disobeyed long ago. I suppose they're people who knew what God expected of them, but ignored that and stubbornly went their own way. That cannot mean just the people from Noah's day, but probably anyone who's ever really seriously disobeyed God. What is important about the journey Jesus made to the underworld or to hell is that God, for some reason, wanted to give the people who were apparently condemned to be forgotten for eternity another chance. He wanted them to live and not to remain dead. We have no clue whether the souls in prison listened to what Jesus had to say when he went to visit them. But what the Apostles' Creed and the First Letter of Peter are really trying to say is that God is insistently merciful. God keeps offering us a chance. As far as God is concerned, we should never think it is too late for change, even after we die. Now, I think anyone who lets that sink in has to be ready to admit that there may be much more to God than we spontaneously realize. People who know they are sinners need not despair, and those prepared to make a list of sinners should not be so presumptuous. When I was learning my religion from a little catechism at school, we were warned that two of the most serious sins in the book were despair and presumption. And I think the message of Holy Saturday is meant to banish both of them. Nobody should feel beyond redemption, and nobody should make them feel that way. A Swiss theologian who wrote about Holy Saturday and the visit to the souls in prison in hell reckoned that this was God's attempt to rescue people who had condemned themselves by their sinful lives to eternal solitude. Jesus took every sin ever committed with him into the realm of the dead, and in that way every sin died with him. He destroyed the power of death and of sin. That does not mean nobody will ever die again and nobody will ever sin again, but that death, which is the most terrifying thing for some people, and sin, which seems to dominate so much of our lives, cannot ultimately dominate our lives. Jesus visited the souls in prison for sin to offer them a way back to life.
And that reflection came from Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. In the meantime, I'd like to wish our listeners a very happy Easter. Laudato Jesus Christus.